Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
If saving more and spending less is one of your top goals for 2023, why are you still paying insane amounts of money every month for your phone bill? Right now, when you switch to Mint Mobile, you'll get their unlimited plan for 50% off. As the first company to sell premium wireless service online only, Mint Mobile lets you order from home and save a ton with phone plans starting at just $15 a month. All plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Cut your wireless bill to 15 bucks a month at mintmobile.com/save. That's mintmobile.com/save. Hurry. Offer ends January 15th.
At Fogo de Chão, everything you see is yours for the tasting. All the exotic fruits and fresh salads from the market table. All the perfectly sliced picanha and tender lamb chops, fire roasted and seasoned with rock salt. And every buttery slice of filet mignon, so unbelievably tender, you'll wonder, is it on your fork or in your dreams? Have it all for one price with the full churrasco. Make a reservation at Fogo.com.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 11th of February, these are our main stories. The US Air Force has destroyed an unidentified object over Alaska days after shooting down a Chinese balloon. More than 23,000 people are now known to have died in the Turkish-Syrian earthquake disaster. And more Russian attacks on Ukraine's energy grid, with claims missiles may have flown over NATO territory. Also in this podcast, pressure mounts on Olympic decision makers not to allow Russian and Belarusian athletes to attend under any circumstances. And
it was so empowering to be able to tackle head on where it's not only the man who always gets the opportunity to save the universe or save the world or save your family.
Michelle Yeoh tells us about her Oscar-nominated performance in the film Everything Everywhere All at Once. US fighter jets have shot down an unidentified object above Alaska. The order was given by President Biden after advice from the Pentagon. This comes only a week after a Chinese balloon was destroyed off the South Carolina coast after occupying US airspace. Beijing said it was a civilian device that was monitoring the weather. Brigadier General Patrick S. Ryder is the Pentagon press secretary.
This was traveling at about 40,000 feet, which posed a reasonable threat to civilian air traffic, and the decision was made to take it down. At that altitude, something that small, no indication that it was manned.
Our Washington correspondent, Nomia Iqbal, told me more.
What Mr. Kirby has emphasized so far is that they don't know if it is a spy balloon, but he's not really saying either way. So just to let you know, Alex, we attended the briefing. And it's the regular briefing that happens at the White House every day and usually at the top of the agenda. Well, today we expect it to be about the Ukraine invasion, about the US's assistance to Turkey following that devastating earthquake, and also the visit by President Lula of Brazil, the first time he's meeting Mr. Biden since they became presidents. But of course, once Mr. Kirby started talking about this unidentified object that was shot down over Alaska, that's what dominated. He's described it as a high altitude object, so it was flying about 12,000 meters in the sky. That's actually at a lower altitude than the spy balloon. He said that Mr. Biden ordered for it to be shot down by the military once a fighter jet approached it and found that it was unmanned. The other thing that he also said is that it was much smaller than the spy balloon and that it could maneuver more easily. But they don't know who owns it. It isn't state-owned, so it is all vague at the moment. They are looking at the debris which fell on frozen ice, and once they know more details, I imagine that they will let us know exactly what this object was, what the intention of this object was.
The Chinese balloon, of course, caused a huge diplomatic incident. It went on for days. President Biden appears to have acted more quickly this time.
Yeah, and the fallout from that still continues, to be honest with you. It was only yesterday that the House of Representatives passed this unanimous non-binding resolution which condemned China, accusing China of deception for false claims, they say, about the spy balloon. China maintains it was a civilian devices you mentioned there used for weather research. But Mr. Biden has faced political pressure. John Kirby said that he ordered for this balloon to be shot down out of an abundance of caution. And when Mr. Biden was asked a few hours ago about this unidentified object, he just put his thumbs up and said it was a success. But yes, there has been pressure on him by Republicans who say that he didn't act quickly enough, that he's weak on China. But Mr. Kirby also said in this press briefing that the president does not regret the way he handled the spy balloon and that he took the action when it was necessary.
Nomia Iqbal in Washington. In Turkey, President Erdogan has acknowledged that search efforts following Monday's huge earthquake have not been as fast as they should have been. His comments come as the latest figures showed more than 23,000 people are now known to have died in both Turkey and Syria. Rescue teams have still not given up hope of finding survivors. Earlier, I got the latest on the relief operation from our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, who's in the Turkish city of Gaziantep, close to where the earthquake struck.
Gaziantep is becoming a relief hub with planes flying in here from around the clock, rescue teams from around the world. And where I'm standing on this long road where there's a whole series of apartment blocks that are still standing, but they are now marked by huge long cracks. So they've all been evacuated because they're seen as dangerous. And in the middle of them, you can hear, I think, the diggers still digging in the rubble. It's such an extraordinary scene here because every so often everyone is told to keep absolutely quiet, and it's happened three times in the short time that we have been here, let's say in the last hour or so, that the rescue teams believe that they sense a sign of life, and so they want everyone to be quiet so that they can check using thermal cameras to see whether, hoping against hope, someone is still alive under this rubble. All around me, the fires are burning in this freezing cold night. Rescue teams, relief workers, people who used to live in these apartment blocks huddling around trying to keep warm. And emotions are really raw. Sometimes you hear cries rising from the crowds as grief boils over in anger. So many people here still hoping that their loved ones will be found under these mounds of rubble.
Lise, when a disaster's on that scale, there are going to be whole cities even where the aid relief, it doesn't do anything.
Just speaking to some of the relief teams I've met here, they've been saying that, you know, when they've been traveling around, they've gone to areas where absolutely not a single rescue worker, not a single relief effort has reached people. And that's the most chilling reports you hear, because you realize that there are people, we still don't know how many, who have died after crying into the rubble with no one there to hear their screams and no one there to try to bring them out alive. But I also have to say, and you know, as I said talking to you, it's freezing cold, the night is dark, there's no electricity, and this area is lit by the bright lights of the diggers and by the fires along the side of the road. And there are some very moving moments. The young volunteers, the Turkish women who came to offer us the bowls of hot steaming soup that they're pouring from a big vat of soup for the rescue workers. The rescue workers whose faces are tired and drawn, and how they keep working through the night and they still come to share a word with you, to say hello. These are the moments which keep you going, which remind you that even in the darkest of times, you can find these brightest of lights.
Lise Doucette in Gaziantep. Well, our correspondent Nick Beek has reached Pazarcik, a small Turkish town at the epicenter of the earthquake, and sent this report.
We came to this town at the heart of this disaster, expecting to see Friday prayers. Instead, it was Friday funerals. A field of more than 100 freshly dug graves, with more than a quarter already filled. An imam said a brief prayer as he looked over each body before shifting across the soil to the next grieving family. Tugba Kalpakla told us she had just buried her 33-year-old nephew and her aunt.
hala şokundayız. Hala bir mesela bir ses duyduğumuz zaman korkuyoruz.
We're still in shock, she says. When the children go to bed, they say, "Mum, please wake me if there's an earthquake. We're in a bad way." But the children are totally wrecked. Just along the fractured road, dozens of families sifted through battered cardboard boxes of donated clothes and shoes. For many, these were the only possessions they had, everything else left behind in the scramble to survive. And among the remarkable stories of survival is that of Seher Kamalak, a teacher. We met her and her two-year-old son, Roni Oli, in front of what remained of their apartment block. It was torn wide open.
The earthquake was never-ending. My son was screaming, but somehow we managed to escape down the stairs.
Turkey's President Erdogan visited this town yesterday, telling residents the calamity was part of fate's plan.
Fate. Fate. There is no fate's plan. Our fate is in our own hands. We write our own destiny. Earthquakes don't kill people. Buildings do.
Like so many others, she is now homeless. But tonight, a rare flicker of joy. She and her son have been reunited with her husband, who's driven for 3 days from Switzerland. But he arrives in a town, like so many others in this region, broken and deep in grief.
Nick Beek. A day after President Zelensky's whirlwind tour of European capitals, Russia has launched a new wave of missile and drone attacks against Ukraine's power grid. Energy facilities were targeted in 6 regions, leaving the country suffering from blackouts. And there are questions over whether Russian missiles have crossed the airspace of Moldova and of the NATO member Romania. Abdujalil Abdurasilov in Kyiv told me more.
According to Ukrainian military, Russia launched 71 rockets and 61 of them were intercepted. And the mayor of Kyiv, Vitaly Klitschko, said that 10 rockets were shot down over the capital and 13 more rockets were destroyed over the southern city of Odessa. But air defenses were in action across the entire country, including in the western regions of Ivano-Frankivsk and Lviv. And we know that some of the missiles did hit energy infrastructure facilities, including the facilities in Khmelnytsky region, in the Lviv region, and especially in Zaporizhia region in the south. So a number of regions in Ukraine are already facing severe power cuts, and energy disruptions are particularly severe in the east, in the Kharkiv region, and in the south, in Zaporizhia region. As for casualties, the authorities are saying that at least 8 people have been injured in Kharkiv. And there's another interesting thing that the Ukrainian commander-in-chief said that 2 cruise missiles crossed Moldovan airspace before reaching Ukraine. And the Moldovan government immediately reacted to that and they summoned the Russian ambassador over this incident.
Yeah, and there's also reports that some of these Russian missiles crossed the airspace of NATO member Romania. Now, Romania says it doesn't think this is true, but where are these reports come from? And if it is true, this is a massive escalation, isn't it?
Yes, that report is coming again from the commander-in-chief, Valery Zaluzhny. So he posted saying that 2 cruise missiles crossed Moldovan airspace and the Romanian airspace before reaching Ukraine. But then Romania denied these reports, saying it didn't happen. However, the Ukrainian military are saying the NATO countries must have observed these launches and followed the trajectory, and surely they knew that it crossed into the airspace of Romania as well. And according to the Ukrainian military, these countries, including Romania, are simply not willing to admit it happened in order to avoid any escalation.
Abdujalil Abdurasilov in Kyiv. The dissident Russian journalist Marina Ovsyannikova has described fleeing Russia late last year while under house arrest, facing criminal charges for protesting against the war in Ukraine. Speaking in Paris, she said she had crossed the Russian border on foot at night with her young daughter. And she described the bubble of propaganda that covered much of Russia's information about the war. Our Paris correspondent Lucy Williamson has been speaking to her.
It was a really dangerous and very stressful escape. I have only two ways, go to prison or escape.
One winter night, a week before she was due to face trial for criticising Russian military action in Ukraine, Marina Ovsyannikova took her young daughter and fled for the border. She was wearing an electronic bracelet and was meant to be under house arrest. My lawyer said, flee, they're going to put you in prison, she told journalists in Paris. She left at the weekend when police searches were less likely and changed vehicles seven times before approaching the border on foot, wandering for hours and navigating by the stars while hiding from border patrols. Now settled in Paris, she says she's still, of course, afraid for her life, but believes that President Putin is risking his leadership over the war in Ukraine.
You know, the elite understands everything perfectly. The people are living in this bubble of propaganda. But the ruling elite, those who have lost their planes, their yacht, their finances, they understand everything. As soon as the Ukrainian victory gets closer, I believe the ruling establishment will present Putin with a big bill.
Ms. Ovsyannikova grabbed headlines around the world last March when she burst into a news broadcast at the state-run TV station where she worked, with a sign reading, don't believe the propaganda, they're lying to you. But despite this and further protests, many Ukrainian journalists and Russian dissidents have expressed mistrust of Ms. Ovsyannikova, pointing to her earlier career as a mouthpiece for the Russian state.
Lucy Williamson in Paris. Still to come on the Global News Podcast.
We did nothing wrong. We prove it. Why should I... don't trust with my people.
Pep Guardiola defends Manchester City against charges they broke more than 100 of the English Premier League's financial rules. The German comedian Dieter Nuhr recently quipped that it would have been nice to have an economy minister who at least had some idea of the economy. But what can you do? There's a labour shortage. The joke has a basis in reality. The National Labour Agency says the shortfall is 400,000 workers a year. People retiring in their 60s are simply not being replaced. Tim Mansell reports on the situation facing German butchers from the district of Lörrach, close to the border with Switzerland.
They're churning out Leberwurst today at the Dosenbach Butchery in Rheinweiler. Glistening links of pinkish-grey sausages slide out of the machine in strings of four. But finding young people to make this staple of German cuisine isn't easy. This is Dorothea Dosenbach, who's been in the business all her life. Her father was a butcher, and now she's married to one.
Zeitungsannoncen, social media Werbung, Internet.
Advertisements in the newspapers, advertisements on social media, advertisements on the internet. We try everything. From the poster in the shop window through to social media.
But to find new people, young people, apprentices, that's really difficult.
Yes.
At the vocational training college in Lörrach, apprentice butchers are putting the mincing machine together. The school's director, Stephanie Frischeis, says the butcher's trade doesn't have the best reputation.
People think that it's a very dirty job. It isn't anymore, but they think it's a dirty job. They think it's a not good paid job, but it is. And they think you have to get up very early. This is right, you have to get up very early.
So in this part of Germany, they've decided to go down a different route to find the next generation of butchers. It began with an email from a large recruitment agency.
It offered young people from India to get to Germany and help our businesses, our companies, to tackle the shortage of labour.
The first 13 apprentices from India have now arrived. They spend one or two days a week at college and the rest on the shop floor in a local butchery. One of the new arrivals is 21-year-old Annika Maria Shazi.
So I studied BSc computer science in degree.
Computer science?
Yeah.
But here you are in Germany in a completely different field.
Computer science is not my cup of tea. I don't want to sit somewhere and coding a computer. I just wanted to be self-independent. I wanted to explore the world.
Meanwhile, Hans-Dirk von Ungern-Sternberg from the Handwerkskammer says 60 more young Indians are coming in 2023.
It's a drop in the ocean at the moment. It needs to grow. So with this project, we showed if you're willing, if you're motivated, if you have the right institutions on board, you will make it. And there is a chance to get motivated young people to Germany.
Tim Mansell with that report. A manifestation of violence. That's how the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has described the possible presence of Russian athletes at next year's Olympics in Paris. He was addressing a virtual summit of sports ministers after the International Olympic Committee indicated they were prepared to allow Russian and Belarusian athletes to compete as neutrals. Nigel Adderley has been following the story. So what else did Mr. Zelensky have to say?
Well, he was typically uncompromising on this matter. He's already said Ukraine will boycott the Olympics if Russian and Belarusian athletes are allowed to compete under any circumstances. And the International Olympic Committee haven't made any decision yet, but they have written to Ukraine saying a boycott will go against the principles of the competition. And they believe it was regrettable that they, in their view, are pressurising other countries to consider a boycott. And President Zelensky framed his response in the light of the missile attacks on his country earlier today.
If the Olympic sports were killings and missile strikes, then you know which national team would occupy the first place. And it is not important whether this national team would have its official flag. So I want to ask you, if representatives of a terrorist state appear the Olympic Games, will it matter if they are there without their national symbols?
So has something been decided, Nigel?
Well, typically at this stage, I think there are compromises being offered because the IOC don't necessarily have to make a decision until maybe the summer of 2024. They will wait and see, I think, to look at what happens in the conflict itself. There were 36 countries around the world represented today, and the general consensus was that the Russian and Belarusian athletes should be banned, although the host nation next year, France, Japan and Greece, all disagreed. And there was a compromise suggested by Poland that there could be a refugee team of dissident athletes and they could be allowed to compete in some circumstances. But we'll have to wait and see what the IOC decide. But it's also worth bearing in mind that a number of athletes who have won medals in the recent past for Russia are employed and trained by the military. And it's difficult to see in any circumstances they being allowed to compete by the IOC. So it could reach a stage where the IOC say you can't have certain athletes competing and Russia could refuse to compete anyway.
Why is there resistance to the idea of a ban?
Well, I think that at the moment, the host nation don't want their event to be compromised because in the past, they've looked at boycotts in 1980 and 1984, and they believe the only people who really suffer are the athletes, and they don't want to repeat here.
Nigel Adderley. The manager of one of the richest football clubs in the world, Pep Guardiola, has insisted Manchester City are innocent after they were charged with more than 100 breaches of the English Premier League's financial rules. Speaking for the first time since the allegations, Mr. Guardiola says he believes the damage to the current title holders has already been done. Our sports editor Dan Rowan reports.
For Manchester City manager Pep Guardiola, this season was meant to be about defending his team's Premier League title. Instead, he's been forced to defend his club from a catalogue of charges about alleged breaches of financial rules since the club's Abu Dhabi takeover in 2008. At a news conference today, the manager was defiant as he addressed the controversy for the first time.
My first thought is that we are already being condemned. So, like, it's happened right now, these weeks after Monday, it's happened the same what happened in UEFA. The club proved that we're completely innocent. I said to them, what happened? So, Pep, we did nothing wrong. We proved it. Now it's the same case. Why should I don't trust with my people?
City had a 2-year UEFA Champions League ban overturned on appeal 3 years ago, and the club says it's supported by irrefutable evidence, with Guardiola suggesting the team's Premier League rivals had been behind the charges. Having previously said he would leave if the club's hierarchy had lied to him, he insisted he was more committed than ever to staying. City could face a points deduction or even expulsion if an independent commission finds them guilty. The manager's challenge is to somehow ensure the looming prospect of one of the sport's biggest ever legal battles does not impact performances on the pitch.
Dan Rowan. Archaeologists in Kenya have dug up some of the oldest stone tools ever used by ancient humans, dating back about 2.9 million years. They say the discovery is evidence that tools were used by other branches of early humans, not just the ancestors of Homo sapiens, or wise man, as we've boastfully called our own species. Dr. Peter Ditchfield from the University of Oxford's School of Archaeology was involved in the research. Tim Franks asked him what the stone tools looked like.
They look a lot like the stone tools that you might find in more well-known sites like Bedwan in Olduvai. They tend to be flakes, so recognisable flakes that have been knocked off of cores, often hammer stones that have multiple flake scars on them. And there's also pounding tools, nice smooth river cobbles that have damage, particularly on the end where they've been used for pounding various materials. So they're quite diagnostic, they're quite clear when you see them. The tool makers at Nyanga aren't new to this. They've clearly mastered the ability to be able to consistently remove flakes from cores. They're able to maintain the angles on those cores so they can take multiple flakes off. They're flaking from multiple directions in some cases. So they're quite advanced. They're not new to the stone tools. That's interesting because that perhaps points to a greater time depth of this type of tool that we haven't yet seen in the fossil record.
Just tell me what they might have been used for, though, these tools.
One of the large concentrations of the tools we've got at this site is associated with the butchered remains of a hippopotamus. And we can find cut marks on those bones. So clearly, the tools are being used for butchery and processing of carcasses. But looking at some of the microscopic damage on the edge of these tools, we're able to determine some of the other things that they may be used for as well. And it seems that some of them are also being used for processing plant resources particularly.
And tell me about these teeth that were discovered nearby, which are seen as being potentially quite significant.
They are likely from the Paranthropus, which is this sister taxa to a lot of the other hominins that's going on. So there are multiple hominins on the landscape at this stage. And these are the robust australopithecines that you may see in reconstructions in another study somewhere, typically have the large sagittal crest and very muscular creatures.
What relation does Paranthropus have to what we all know about, which is Homo sapiens?
From most studies, it's not really directly on the tree that leads to Homo sapiens, and it's not part of Homo. It's this sort of sister taxa, this Paranthropus, that are running alongside Homo, and they are much more robust and much more capable of making these stone tools. They certainly have the physical attributes that allow them to do that.
The sophistication you were talking about in terms of these tools and the age of them, does it make us reevaluate how advanced these ancient species were?
Yes, I think it opens up the possibility. We're not saying that Paranthropus was actually making these tools. Obviously, it's going to be very hard to actually prove that. They're associated with them at this site. But we do have older tools from elsewhere in Africa, an industry called the Lamequian, and that's maybe 3.3 million years old. And that predates our earliest Homo by some considerable way. So we know that there's a very good chance that it's not just early Homo and the lineage that goes on to create modern humans who are making tools, but it opens the possibility up that actually multiple lineages are making and using these tools in Africa at this time.
Dr. Peter Ditchfield from the University of Oxford's School of Archaeology speaking to Tim Franks. It's hard to describe the film Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. An American-Chinese family who are plunged from their dry cleaning business into a crazy world of multiple universes, shape-shifting characters, hands turning into hot dogs. The movie's been a big hit, and its star, Michelle Yeoh, who became famous many years ago for Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, has become the first Asian to be nominated for the Best Actress Oscar. She's been speaking to the BBC's Martha Carney about the film.
It is so unique, so weird, wacky. It's almost impossible to describe, but somehow something resonated. I think what it was about a very ordinary, aging Asian immigrant woman. She's unseen to us, yet she is everywhere around us. It was so empowering to be able to tackle head on where it's not only the man who always gets the opportunity to save the universe or save the world or save your family.
And even though the film has such craziness in it, such mad moments and lots of humour, it is emotionally complex too, isn't it? Because it's about lives not lived.
Yes. Through the eyes of Evelyn Wong, so many of us walk that path where we sometimes think, if only, with a little bit of regret, with a little bit of, I wish I had not done that. And I think it is very prevalent in our communities where immigrant parents constantly remind the next generation, we could have had this, but because of you and wanting a better life for you, we have chosen, to be here so that you will have something better. So one thing that has come out from this movie is when we have different generations, people of my age would come up to me and say, well, I'm not sure I get your film completely, but you have started a conversation with my estranged daughter that I have not spoken to for 2 years. She has actually reached out to me. And for me, that is really special.
So it's a film which sheds light on those differences between generations in the Asian community. And you've said that the Oscar nomination was very important for Asian audiences.
Oh, my goodness. It has been quite the journey. When it happened, it was like, how can I be the first Asian to be nominated? Because there were so many great actresses that came before me who are with me and will continue to be with me. So I hope this is the start of a whole new world for us.
And in some of the speeches that you've been making about the recognition you're getting, you've talked about the kind of racism that you had to face when you were beginning.
I started my career in Hong Kong, and it was the ultimate dream for every filmmaker from the East to start making movies in Hollywood, because that's where it all begins, right? I didn't want to be put in that box. And I think sometimes when you have a strong enough belief, you have to fight for what you believe in.
There was criticism about the fact that two black actresses, Daniel Deadwyler and Viola Davis, didn't get nominations. I wondered what you thought.
Oh, I love Viola and Danielle Deadwyler too. I wish, honestly, that we were all just getting the Oscars. It's tough to be pitched against each other. It took me like 40 years to get even a nomination. Every single one actor, actress, filmmaker pour their heart and soul into the stories that they want to tell. And I don't think we started the journey thinking this is what we're aiming for. The stories that we want to tell is much more important than that. I want every one of us to get the Oscars. I want the Oscars. And, it's a validation from your peers to say, we see you, recognize you. It's taken so long to be seen and recognized. And, when you started the conversation, it was not even just about me. It's a validation for people who look like me to be there, to be part of this group.
Michelle Yeoh speaking to Martha Carney. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Rob Fanner, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
Hello, my name's Jonathan Myerson, and before you get to your chosen podcast, I want to ask you one question. How did an insignificant army corporal end up as Chancellor of all Germany? It's a story that's improbable and also a lesson for us all. My new podcast, Nazis, The Road to Power, unravels it in 16 dramatised episodes, starring Tom Mothersdale, Derek Jacobi, Toby Stevens, Alexander Vlahos, and Laura Donnelly. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.